Ken MacLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind, 37 Practices of a Bodhisattva, Part 3.
So, should we turn to the text? So we're looking at 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. Okay. Well, let's, as I say, the first thing I'd like to do is just to take up any questions any of you have about any lines in the text in terms of what they mean, or you suspect there are translation points, there's differences between how I translated them and somebody else translated them, and you're curious about that. And this is in the area of comprehension.
In all 4, 5, and 6?
In all four verses, yeah. Okay, Joe.
On 7, my first understanding was a mistaken one, because locked in the prison of their own patterning, whom can the ordinary gods protect? Because of the closeness of whom to to patterning, I assumed that it meant that whom was the one locked up in their own patterning. In other words, myself.
Us. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But then I realized on reading other translations that
the gods
are locked up.
That's right. Yeah.
They're not locked up.
No, the gods are locked in their
own
pattern.
That's what
okay,
I thought.
Yeah, okay. George?
In 4, the last line, forget the conventional concerns.
Yeah, that's one I underlined.
You know, we had Stephen, Michelle, and I talked about this at dinner time today. We saw a number of different ways of looking at it, and one. And maybe there are different levels, like the exoteric and esoteric and ultimate level, or different ways of looking at it. But conventional concerns, also this life, also this incarnation.
Well, I'd underline this as a potential one to discuss. The Tibetan is Tse Di Lotong. And it means, literally, get rid of the mind that is focused on this life. And probably most people translated it something like that. Now, when I translate, there are a couple of things I try to do. One is, I try as much as possible not to make belief in past and future lives a condition for understanding the text. And second, although it sounds like English, it isn't really English. Get rid of the mind that focuses on this life. You know. Ooh. Well, of course I focus on this life. Why wouldn't I? You know, the meaning in Tibetan is not captured by the phrase focus on this life. Because, you know, we have food and things like that. And so I chose to be a little more interpretive here. Because what it's really referring to is the agendas defined by conventional notions of society, etc. You know, conventional success and failure, what you're meant to be doing as a member of the society. And that's really what it's directed at. And so I decided to render it in a way that made that meaning explicit. Now, in doing so, I probably opened up other areas of interpretation, which actually is fine, because one of the things that I started to do in translating, probably about 10 or 15 years ago, is to translate where I could with a deliberate ambiguity so that the English became rich and full of interpretations rather than focusing on just one thing, because the Tibetan is rich and full of interpretations, and just if pick one of the many possible meanings and translate that actually does a disservice to the text in some way. Okay. Julia.
Yes, when I read that, I thought also about the eight worldly concerns. Does
yeah.
that also apply?
Well, those are the things that are you know, that's exactly what focusing on this life means. You're concerned with happiness and unhappiness, success and failure, gain and loss, fame and obscurity, respect and disdain. You know, that's what one focuses on. Yeah. Robert?
Back to verse 7. The words ordinary gods. Can you say a little more about that?
Sure. The Tibetan is... Yeah. That's what I thought it was. The Tibetan is Jigten La. Jigten is the word for the world of ordinary experience. And it literally means the container for everything that can be destroyed, which is a great way to refer to the universe. But what does that mean? Well, everything's destroyed by impermanence. And so when it says the ordinary gods, or it would, you'll see this almost always translated as worldly gods. But again, I just didn't like that in terms of the English. It's standard Buddhist English, but I'm very tired of Buddhist English. And I'm trying to put it into English. So that's why I chose the word ordinary, because... these people, or these gods, have not stepped out of reactive patterns. They're caught up in them in exactly the same way that we are.
So in Buddhism, I mean, or in the Tibetan texts, are they actually using the word gods?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, and again, one can look at this in different terms, different ways of interpretation. So, to respond to Michelle, the Buddhists were always beating up on the Hindus, so they would regard Brahma, Vishnu, Indra, etc., as worldly gods. Indra lives in the 30th, the heaven with the 33 levels, or the 33 level palace, or whatever it is, and thinks he's lord of the universe, but actually he just got a hell of a lot of good karma, and it's going to last him for a few billion eons, but then he'll be back in the hell realms like the rest of us. I think it's in the Sarangama Sutra. There's a categorization of various forms of meditation and fixations, and the corresponding god realm that you'll be born in. So if you have this kind of fixation, you'll become a god who thinks he's the creator of the universe. And if you get this one, you'll become a god who thinks he's this, and so forth. And he goes through all of the various notions of deity and tracks them down to coming from very particular meditation fixations. It's kind of interesting that way. Sort of devastating to all the other religions, but that's another matter. And it definitely uses the word gods as something that is we regard as higher or superior and has some kind of power and intervene in us. Now, the way that my colleague Michael Conklin and I, and a lot of other people now, approach this is, what are the gods in our society? Well, what are the gods? Beauty. Money, thinness, you know, and if you fame, and if you look at the Greek mythology, that's exactly who their gods were. Pardon? Well, there was Aphrodite, which is beauty. And there was war, and some people regard war as a god. There's Ares, or that's the Roman name. What was the
name?
Oh, Mars was the Roman. That's right, Ares is the Greek. And so forth. So a mythology consists of the anthropomorphization of the of our own obsessions. And then it becomes a whole pantheon, etc., etc. But that's what our gods are. Money, power, so forth. And health is another one. I'm going to be perfectly healthy. A friend of mine who used to counsel people with AIDS, all of these people living such pure lives, and in the end they're going to find themselves dying of absolutely nothing. So, and when it says go for refuge, this means where do we go for security? And absolutely in our society people go for security and money. And they think that's where they're going to find security and happiness and fulfillment, etc., etc. And it's a bit of a shock to people when they realize that they don't. In my work at HBO, one person left while I was coaching her. And there's a good possibility another person is. So I'm going to have an interesting reputation there soon. And the reason is through our interaction they're coming to realize that the job they have isn't the sum total of who they want to be. But in an institutional setting, that's exactly what you try to sell the person. This job is you. And that's how you, that people are chained into an organization. But it isn't. And one of the things that I found consistently with meditation practice, that after about, somewhere around 9 months of a consistent meditation practice, sometimes it's a bit longer, sometimes it's 2 or 3 years, but it usually begins at around 9 months, people start letting go of their identification of themselves with their job. They still will do their work very competently, but their job is no longer what they are. And that's a very, very important transition, because it's stopping taking refuge in work, which is exactly what a lot of people do. Okay, Clint.
What's the meaning of friend? Verse 5.
Well, it is... it's who you hang out with.
You've already gotten rid of the first in verse 4. Long time friends you're going to separate, and then it brings it up again, which I thought was kind of strange.
Well,
is that your gang?
Unless you interpret that you'll separate from them when you die.
No.
When you die. Oh.
Let me see.
Separating?
Oh, yeah, well, it is the... verse 4 says you're going to separate your friends and relatives with whom you've associated for a long time, you're going to separate from. As people have said, it definitely means they're talking about death here. That verse is about death. The subsequent verse, verse 5, is about who you hang out with now.
So why would they bring in verse 4 this thing about death, when this is one of the practices of Bodhisattva, is holding death in mind at all times?
Well, let's take a look at it at a slightly deeper level. We have spouses and partners and people we have intimate relationships. We have our children. We have our work colleagues, people we do things with, people we play with, okay? And we say we have all of these relationships. Of what does the relationship actually consist?
You're asking me?
Yes.
Connection? What does the... You mean each relationship that you're talking about?
Well...
Attachment.
There are all of those things there. Mm-hmm. But take your husband.
Right.
Okay? You're going to hate me for this in the morning, but...
I know. I can tell.
Okay. What is your husband in your world?
Everything to me.
Yeah.
And I know he's emptiness, too. He doesn't really even exist, but... I mean, everything.
Well, he might have something to say about it. Okay. But I don't want to use... I'm trying to figure out how to point this out to you without giving it to you.
Okay.
Okay, so...
He's a long-time friend.
Yes.
And a relative.
Yeah.
No, I mean, he's my husband.
In any instance where you see him or think of him, what is that?
Connected to he's me in a way. I mean, he's a reflection of me. Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't
but
know.
What is, there's no way to do this. I can't think of
one.
I just spit it out. Yeah, I can't. think. You have a series of experiences mm-hmm. of meeting a certain person, interacting with a certain person, or interacting with something you call a certain person. And you put those all together and say, you know, this is my husband. But all you actually have is a set of experiences, which, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's all of that's all any of us have about anything. There's just this set of experiences. And we build up certain experiences are deeply webbed into our whole thing. And so we say there's a person and I have a strong connection with them. But in any single instance, it is simply an experience. Now, when you look at things that way, what happens? Let me be a little more specific. Do things close down or do they open up? Why is that?
It's an external distraction that gets rid of these experiences.
Gets rid of
the impermanence of it.
Actually,
it
highlights.
It highlights.
It gets rid of the permanence that you're projecting onto the whole thing.
Yes.
Okay. And
isn't an experience ongoing? Or
yes.
Yeah.
But you get to experience the person now new each time, if you look at it just as an experience.
This is why I hold on to things. they keep experience in a concretized form. It's like it's clearly interesting.
Right.
I have a question.
Please.
I'm picking up the kind of difference between things, you know, separable things and some sort of ongoing something.
Yeah.
And
you want me to talk about that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, yeah. This is the difference in perspective. That, and you've all heard me say this before, what our life consists of are thoughts, feelings, and sensations. Out of that, we construct a world of objects. That's what we construct out of the sensory sensations. reconstruct an identity, actually, out of the emotions, and reconstruct stories out of all of the thoughts. And all of these interact and weave together to form a nice solid web. And now we relate to the world that we've constructed as what is real. Does anybody have a copy of my book here? Pardon? No. My book. Good grief.
I do.
You get a gold star.
Here it is.
Okay.
Let me take all my personal references out.
Well, I'm just going to look at one page.
Okay.
Remember.
Don't look at any of my private notes.
Someone sent me a link to, this is quite a long time ago, to Octavio Paz's Nobel acceptance speech, and I recommend reading it. You can find it on the web quite easily. Octavio Paz. Why isn't it there? Oh, it's back here. I know, we read it last night. Or Monday night. Yes. So, and one of the things that he talks about in this speech is his experience in childhood in moving from the world of thoughts, feelings, and sensations, which is where the child lives, into the adult world of objects and people and time. So this is just a small piece from it, but it'll give you the idea. Any piece of news, a harmless phrase, the headline in the newspaper, everything proved the outside world's existence and my own unreality. I felt that the world was splitting and that I did not inhabit the present. My present was disintegrating. Real time was somewhere else. In spite of what my senses told me, the time from over there, belonging to the others, was the real one, the time of the real present. Okay? Thanks. So, we're moving into the second pass here. When you reflected on this, what came up for you? And again, anything. So, Julia.
Question. In previous teachings and instructions from you, we've received the instruction to continuously move into experience. And I remember you telling the story about the teacher and the keyboard and how useful it is to have these enemies and nuisance factors around so we can generate bodhisattva qualities such as patience. That seems to contrast with the advice here when we're being asked to sort of remove ourselves from associating with people who are bad influences. So I wondered what if you could speak to that.
Well, I'm thinking of taking up windsurfing, but I'm really miffed because I missed the great opportunity to learn how to windsurf. I could have used Hurricane Katrina. You know, good solid wind there. John?
I got something from number 6.
Yes.
I was resisting watching Crash again. And I really had to force myself to do it, but only because of revising that you suggested.
Is that the reason you watched it?
I've seen it.
Yes. Because I'd suggested it.
Because I trusted you.
Why did you take that suggestion?
I
It's not in there. I think there are a bunch of other factors. Are you going to come to film night?
You're suggesting that maybe I didn't want to come to film night not having seen it?
Or not having seen it recently? Is that, so did that enter into it at all?
Could have been.
What I'm saying is...
I still think I was inspired more to force myself to do it.
So was I...
Because I trusted you.
And from your experience, was I falling into the category of verse 5 or verse 6?
verse 6.
You sure it wasn't verse 5?
Sorry.
No, no. What's your point here, John? It wasn't a pleasant experience for me. That's what I'm gathering. So are you asking me, why did I make the suggestion?
No, or I'm so saying what why I pushed myself into watching.
Right. Now, do you regard that as a good thing or a bad thing? Or
no,
what?
I'm very glad I did.
Oh, okay. You left that little bit out. Why are you glad?
Well, I enjoyed it the second time quite a bit more than I thought I was going to.
Ah.
And it might have been because it was on a small screen and I wasn't being as critical. And any number of reasons, but I'm saying that what inspired me to do it
was the fact that I pushed a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, it's okay to say that. I'm a pushy guy. Sometimes I'm nice about it.
More in terms of the teacher dear to you.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I understand that. Now, with some teachers, your shortcomings fade away and abilities grow like the waxing moon. Hold such teachers dear to you, dearer than your own body. Let's take a little closer look at that. When you associate with certain people, shortcomings fade away and abilities grow. Why does that happen? It's not magic. They don't sprinkle twinkle dust or whatever, pixie dust. What happens?
It's in you. Let there.
Pardon?
It seems like it's in you and you just get led there by these people. Bringing out the best.
And how does that happen? And the reason that I'm pushing this one a little bit is because you're very interested in how you interact with each other. So this is very important. I think that's a good example, and thank you. So, what is happening in the interaction?
Coming into presence.
And let's not use any cliches here.
Resonance of shared intention.
Well, I mean, let's take Perry's example, because I think it's quite clear. Her experience was a person outside her, in this case it was me, was taking her practice seriously. What did that do in you? What did it make possible, and what did it make impossible?
On retreat. And it made it impossible. possible for me to diminish or minimize
ignore. Yeah. So that's the kind of thing that happens. When I was studying martial arts, martial arts teacher was very good at this. Anytime somebody said, "I can't do that," he'd hit the roof. He said, "I never want to hear those words. I know what you can do. I'm an expert in this. If I say you can do it, you can do it. So don't tell me you can't." No, that was his version of compassion. But it was very, very effective. And he would just yell at the person, "Don't tell me that, because you're telling yourself that," etc., etc. So, what is the difference between the people in verse 5 and the people in verse 6?
Degrading clarity versus enhancing clarity.
I want to make it more specific, George. What is the difference in how they interact with you?
Their intention is completely different.
Make it explicit, George.
In the first case, their intention is towards the worldly concerns or worse.
Mm-hmm.
In the spiritual friend's intention is to uncover the fullness of who you are and of your awareness of at its highest level.
Yeah. I'm going to make it a little more explicit than you have. In the verse 5, these people are intent on using you. In verse 6, these people are intent on developing you.
I also see it as using the word energy.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who take your energy,
yeah,
drain it, and there are people interaction give rise to more.
Any other points coming out of reflection here? Well, there's just one second. There are a lot of other people that we haven't heard from. I want to make sure they have a chance. Janaki?
Akin to this.
Okay, this is an important point, and I want to talk about it a little bit. Pardon? Oh, I'm sorry. Spiritual ambition, yes. Yeah. That's a tough one. Okay. I remember a friend of mine went to, I think it was Manindra, who's one of the really, really big Theravadan teachers, because he was stuck in this practice, and he explained where he was. And Manindra listened to him very patiently, very attentively. And when he finished explaining his difficulties, Manindra looked at him and just asked him two questions. He said, "Do you understand the teachings and what they say?" "Yes." "Are you spiritually ambitious?" "Yes." And then Manindra just shook his head and said, "What a pity." Okay. Give up bad friends. one can look at this very literally, which Jiaozi Tome undoubtedly means. But in the way that we were talking last one, one can also look at it as, what do you do with negativity in your experience? And here, there are three ways of working with it. And which way you use depends on your ability with respect to that particular experience of negativity. If you have sufficient capacity and attention, you can experience the negativity and not lose attention. And when that happens, what is negative opens up and releases, and the energy locked in it becomes available to you in your practice. And you can actually experience that with people, that if you are present with them, not reacting, their negativity can release, and a very different kind of relationship and different possibilities can open up in them. And I know many of you have experienced that kind of thing, either being with someone who's had that transforming effect on you, or you having that transforming effect on them. So that's where you can actually drink the negativity, and it enriches you, which is Vajrayana level practice. If you don't have a sufficient capacity to do that, then trying to do that is actually counterproductive. So then you use, you make the enemy into a friend, an ally, which is analogous, you know, you're going to have this fight and you meet this person, you say, well, why don't we go down to the pub and have a drink? And you'll end up buddies, and so you've changed it. The principal practice that you have for that is taking and sending. And in any experience of negativity, there is a sense of separation and alienation, and in taking and sending, you actually bridge that. But if you don't have the capacity to form a relationship that way, and we don't all do, you know, I was actually working on an area in my own practice, and I discovered this quite large area, which I don't have any relationship with. So I've got, my work's cut out for the next few months. It looks like a fun ahead. If you don't have the capacity to form a relationship with it, then it's actually best to limit contact.
To
limit contact.
Yeah.
Because you can't experience it without getting lost in it. It's not where you want to end up. That's a short term, or it's a practical thing to do in the short term. Now, look at these not as absolute injunctions, but pragmatic advice. Yeah. These are not the Ten Commandments, you know, which is God's word engraved in stone. You know, and they've been trying to engrave it in stone and install it in courthouses all over. Yeah, they really want it. These are instructions. These are practices, which doesn't mean you get to do whatever you want, but how do you use them? Well, if you hang out with certain people, you get distracted. You know, they want to stay up late and drink and have a good time. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that it weakens your intention in your life. That's all. So look at this in pragmatic terms. Now, does that is that a useful response to?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
That's the way I experienced it.
Okay.
And I utilized several of those techniques.
Good. And there is that progression. Yeah, there is that progression. In the first stanza four, it's like saying, okay, every relationship you have is going to end. Which means stop making any relationship the ultimate thing in your life. It's all going to end. Every one of them. Okay? And the next one is, okay, these are relationships which actually don't do anything for you. They make your life worse. These are relationships which make your life better. And then when you get to refuge, it says, and this is what you're really focused on. You know, focus your attention here. This is what's really important. So there is that exactly that kind of progression. Okay, Steve?
This number five is interesting. What John he says, when I first started studying and practicing, that was a question I had. What are all these people that I feel negative things? And so a teacher said that, just told me about that, that there's a difference between judgment and discretion.
Yeah, very
and
good.
He said it's okay to have discretion and say these things are probably not in my best interest right now. And that's what I took from it.
Okay. Now, I don't want to go too late tonight, so what were the challenges you faced, maybe none, in really incorporating this in meditation, really taking it in deeply? What did you encounter there? Joe?
Something happened to me in meditation, which I think it was a result of the discussion last week. And, for example, number four, which started out in meditation as a basic meditation on death and impermanence, soon led to the realization that maybe what I'm thinking about is not the end of my life, but what's true about right now. In other words, I am already separate from long. It's a description of what actually is now. I am separate from long-time friends and relatives. I have left behind the wealth because it's not really part of me, in essence. And the consciousness is not my body. I'm not my body.
Okay.
So the reflection is always what is true right now. And the same is true with God. So who is my ordinary God? Who do I look to protect me? Apart from societal things, just who I am.
Yeah. Okay, very good. That's a very good thing to reflect on. And where do I actually go for refuge? That's what you're asking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Anybody else? Susan. Mm-hmm. I bet you have.
More ways than one. And I realize that it's not something that I just sort of do at the beginning of our prayers or at the beginning even of becoming a Buddhist, but it's something that is done over and over. And it's kind of, it's sort of a radical and even counterintuitive way to do it.
Say a bit more there. So it's an ongoing practice for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you, Catherine, can I borrow the book again?
Oh, the book.
Yeah.
Never in my
I won't look. This is also up on the website in somewhat more abbreviated form. But the section on refuge, which is. Page, here we go. 43, following. I offer three levels of interpretation of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. There's the historical Buddha, the words that have been recorded and comprise the core teachings, and then the monks which have carried on the tradition of the Sangha through the centuries. But you can also say that there is Buddha in the sense of awake mind. And there is Dharma in the sense of lived experience of the teaching, direct experience. So rather than compassion being a concept, you experience being compassionate. And the Sangha at that level are the people who actually help you bring that about. And a third way of looking at it is to take refuge in the Buddha is to rest in the emptiness of original mind, free from any reference or defining characteristic. This is on page 46. To take refuge in the Dharma is to experience the clarity of original mind, the natural awareness that knows what experience is and how experience arises. And to take refuge in the Sangha is to be one with the unrestricted arising and subsiding of experience. So, thanks. What was wonderfully ironic is that when I was organizing a program with Yvonne and Ajahn Amaro is trained in the Theravadan tradition, said, we never take refuge in Buddha as the teacher. The only refuge that he was familiar with was that last one, taking refuge in the emptiness, clarity, and unrestricted experience of mind itself. So there are all of these levels. Good. Okay. Just want to make sure there's anybody else. Okay, Perry.
I was sort of thinking about it as
quarter be.
Mm-hmm.
Like letting each thought be it.
Wasn't easy. Right. Okay. Other practice points? Robert.
I don't know if it's a practice point as much as my experience with number five.
Mm-hmm.
Friends that I experienced weren't outer friends, but the inner friends, the habituated patterns of which I've become.
That's very good.
And to me, each of those friends were one of the six realms. And so which one of those, where was the attachment to each of those realms? Where was the aversion? Where was the indifference?
Mm-hmm. And where was the seduction? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good.
And was the awakened friend also in you?
Yeah, but that's not the one they're talking about. They're talking about the ones with the three poisons.
Yeah, that was the five I was talking about, sex.
Okay. Anybody else? Clint.
Fairly technical question, maybe. How do you take in these verses through meditation?
Well, I'm going to let somebody else answer that one. Anybody want to take this one? You've all been working on it. Somebody should be able to do this. Sure.
The way that I work with it is that I'll read the passages and many times, usually, and see what grabs me the most. And then I will sit with that in meditation. Think about it for a few moments, but then sort of sit with the effect of the thought and do that and see what develops in the process.
From the beginning or after going through 10 or 15 minutes?
Well, in meditation,
foundation.
I'll sit with my breath for a while first and then focus on a line that really grabs my attention and sit with the actual feeling, experience, or sense of that. And I think, don't think repetitively about it, but I'll think the line or the phrase or the paragraph and see what actually arises as I sit with the kind of reverberation.
You let it rattle around in you.
Mm-hmm.
So take any verse, let's say. Take verse 6, Clint. You read this over. With some teachers, your shortcomings fade away. Abilities grow like the waxing moon. Hold such teachers dear to you, dearer than your own body. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. Now, here's one way to do this. When you read the whole verse, what line or phrase grabs your attention, evokes something in you, stimulates you?
The waxing moon.
Okay. Abilities grow like the waxing moon, that phrase. Okay. So you could just sit with that. And as Elizabeth was noting, and was mentioning, you go through the usual drill here. Abilities grow like the waxing moon. What happens in my body? What are the emotions connected with that? What are the stories? So you really come into connection with that, and as Elizabeth was saying, that's kind of the effect that the phrase has in you, right? And that's why I meant you let it rattle around or reverberate around in you. And you may uncover in the process, I don't think my abilities grow like that. Well, now you've just identified a self-image, a restricting self-image. And so you can work with that. You know, and or you can go from there and explore. Okay, what do I actually experience in the interaction with my teacher? Is it an opening? Is it a closing? And so you're really taking it in very deeply. Does this help?
Yes.
Okay.
There is an explanation in the piece that Michelle put up from that nun in Seattle, Buddhist nun in Seattle. An explanation, huh?
Thupten. T-H is pronounced T.
That person. And it's an explanation of, I think, what she calls analytic meditation.
Yep.
It's very helpful because she explains how we do it all the time. We take what somebody said about somebody. If we talk about it, like, something that somebody said about somebody and play that in our mind and say, oh, yeah, that's... And we can do the same thing with the things we read outside, on the pillow, but also outside of meditation. Oh, yeah, Ken said that, or I read that. And it works. It works to rattle around that.
Exactly.
I think you can.
Go ahead.
I think one thing you can do is also ask a question of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even repeatedly. An example: How do I act as a bodhisattva in everyday life when what I'm doing has nothing to do with what is in this 37 practices most of the time? This is, you know, I'm in mundane existence. A lot of the time, it seemed to me. So I asked myself, how can I apply this in my regular life? And for the longest time, there seemed to be a real separation, like a real dichotomy there. It's like night and day. Then a few days later, actually came the notion, the answer, look for the highest good in any situation.
Okay. So that's a reflective process. You throw up a question and let it rattle around until something comes out of it. Okay, Harry?
I use a similar process. Like, I usually ask, is this true for me? And then,
that'll take it in deeply, yeah. Is it true for me? And if it isn't, then what prevents it from being true for me? Now, I do want to caution, when you're taking that kind of approach, it's very good. It's fairly easy to become quite judgmental about ourselves.
I don't think I need any help with that.
Well, yes, but that's the danger that I'm pointing to.
But when I say it's not true about me, it's more like, does this resonate as true for me?
Okay.
Which I think is slightly different.
All right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Can you still speak
about this? Yes. Because when we read these things, it's very easy to feel that this is a prescription of how we should behave. Now, this is rather a description of how a bodhisattva lives. Okay? And we aspire to it. But if we adopt a punitive approach to ourselves, I'm not doing this, and I should be doing better, etc., that kind of judgmental attitude, this actually becomes counterproductive. Because now we're reinforcing a negative self-image. Do you follow? And that's why I mean, as he says, this is a practice of a bodhisattva. This isn't something you suddenly just be. This is what you seek to practice. Now, all of you know this with respect to meditation. How many of you, the first time you meditated, just rested consistently with the breath? Okay. And yet many people take that as the criterion for success or failure. I have so many people, and a good number of you, who came in soon after your practice and said, this isn't for me, I failed. I wandered all over the place. I didn't keep my attention on the breath for more than half a breath. you know. Okay. But you practice it. And what happens is you practice it. Well, eventually you're able to stay with the breath for one whole breath. Then you have that magic moment where it comes three breaths in a row. And like, oh, that was different. And this is how to approach this. These are things you practice, and you're going to fall down and not do them again and again and again. So don't form a negative opinion of yourself at that point. Just say, okay, that's that. Go on to the next. There's the next moment. Okay. I just want to check at this point. How is this evening for you?
Good.
Does this work?
Yes.
More dynamic.
Yeah. Can we go on this way?
Yes.
I don't have permission.
We'll have to go.
Okay. Raquel, can you leave me?
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.